Valvoline Instant Oil Change presents Wisdom from the Road.
Summer means wide open spaces and a whole lot of extra miles. The last place you want your engine to give out is halfway to nowhere. Out here, low oil or a weak battery is just an ambush waiting to happen. That's why every oil change at Valvoline Instant Oil Change includes an 18-point maintenance check. These techs are trained to help spot issues early and keep you riding easy. Change wisely.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, Buzz Aldrin secretly took communion on the moon.
The Catholic Church bans meat during Lent, but you're allowed to eat beaver.
And the 13th century theologian Thomas Aquinas was reportedly so fat he had a curved chunk of wood sawn out of his dinner table so he could fit his belly in.
This week we're talking about holy food. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Alex. I'm here with my fellow QI elf Manu. Hello, Manu.
Hey, Alex.
And we're also here with a very special guest, John Mitchinson.
Thank you. How marvellous to be here.
I want to describe you as a founding father of QI. Is that correct?
I think you can say that. A sort of Benjamin Franklin of QI.
I feel like I've seen an oil painting of you with the first script. Everyone's wearing curly head wigs. Thank you so much for joining us. So do you want to tell everyone a bit about how you're connected to QI and what you're doing now?
Yes. I was the very first person, I think, when John decided he was going to actually turn an idea into a business. I ended up being director of research for about a decade, and we produced over 10 books together. But the Book of General Ignorance is the one that probably everybody remembers.
Quite a biblical name, actually, now that I think about it.
Now you think about it.
It's actually a great name for the Bible.
Since then, I've been a publisher, and now I'm a writer and a podcaster. I've got a podcast called Backlisted. And as of September, I'm starting training for ordination. As an Anglican priest.
Amazing.
It's very exciting.
Great. Well, perfect then that we happen to be talking, what a coincidence, about food, and it's going to be food and Christianity is the episode, but I think we'll probably start off on a more general note.
I was really interested in food restrictions and taboos, because that's the thing I think of first when I think about religion and food and worship. And obviously you have so many other things like celebration and feasting, but growing up a Muslim, that was my biggest experience of religion and food, was the rules, the things I couldn't eat. I didn't eat pork until I was 18, and that was an enormously big moment and very tasty.
I love that, like, the rest of us all went out drinking, you know, and you just, like, went to massive kebab roast.
As a pig keeper, this obviously is important.
Oh, you keep pigs? Amazing.
Do you eat them?
Yes, I'm afraid I do. There's no good reason to keep them, although, I mean, they're amazing, intelligent and beautiful animals. That's why
they
I do keep them.
They are also really tasty. Yeah. But, yeah, I was looking at where this tradition comes from, and apparently there had been prohibitions long before the kind of Abrahamic traditions were introduced. And one of the reasons, so this is quite a recent paper written by a historian called Richard Redding, one of the reasons that they've kind of fell out of favour in these areas, kind of along the Fertile Crescent where these big traditions come from, apparently, is because people preferred chicken. Oh. When chickens were domesticated and came in, they took up way less space. They were much easier to travel around with. They drank less, they ate less, and they laid eggs. So they were like, this makes way more sense. So the pigs fell out of favour and chickens started coming into the fold. There are lots of other really cool reasons why you'd ban certain foods, which I'd never thought about.
Especially like rules on preparing food in a certain way. That actually comes down to hygiene.
Yeah, pigs in particular, is because they're more likely to carry zootonic diseases. So ones that jump between pigs and humans. One is resource management. Yeah. So if you have communities of people who are eating and hunting the same animals, it kind of makes sense for another community to like diversify and go for something else. So those animals that are being over hunted become taboo. There's also empathy. So in some religious systems, you care a lot about animals especially if you think of them as having human souls. So if you think about reincarnation in a Buddhist and Hindu traditions, and like kind of totem animals, animism. So that's a really big, big part. My favorite one I had never thought about was having a monopoly on certain foods. Basically just people deciding like, you know what, this is super tasty, we're going to keep it for ourselves. So this happens apparently a lot in patriarchal traditions. So there's an Australian Aboriginal community that save honey for only very old and very wise men. So only they get to eat the super sweet sweet.
That's very clever. Mitch, as someone going into the church, do you have anything you're particularly looking forward to with food? I mean, for me, like, religion and food equals Christmas, which is the best bit.
I've always, we now do, twice a year, we do a feast in the church, which I have to say is something that probably happened a lot more back in the day, in the pre-Reformation. Yeah. There's a tremendous old custom of wits and ales, where the church wardens would raise money to pay for any church repairs by brewing extremely strong beer and throwing a big party. And people were then supposed to contribute. They are like so much else. The good old Middle Ages were banned under the
Puritans.
Under the Puritans.
And bring it back.
I think there is a whole movement now, particularly for younger people, who think that actually that there's not enough celebration in the Christian tradition. There is something really quite remarkable about sitting in a medieval building with a long table with food. As you say, you have got the great feasts, you've got Christmas, but Easter's also got quite a lot of food tradition around it. Yeah. And you've got the whole period of Lent and Advent before Christmas, which used to be a kind of another period of fasting as well. So my feeling always is that one of the things about fasting is it makes you appreciate, as anybody knows, you never appreciate your food more than when you break fast.
I also had no idea there was a link between fasting in particular and enlightenment and hallucination. I was talking to a food historian called Christina Ward, who's written an incredible book called Holy Food. And she was talking about all of these kind of ancient traditions of nearly starvation, creating incredible visions. And you have a lot of these old texts that talk about talking to a deity and having that intimate relationship with them, which was probably induced by being incredibly hungry.
I actually did one of the crucial moments in the last 2 years that put me on the pathway to this strange late life choice was I did a 4-day solitary fast.
Whoa.
Did you?
On Dartmoor, up on the top of a hill on Dartmoor. You weren't really supposed to walk and you couldn't take books. You were there on your own with some water for 4 days and 4 nights.
Wow.
And I can confirm, Manu, that by the end of that period, I think you are in, let's just say, receive mode. It's pretty, I definitely saw and felt and thought about things differently at the end of that.
Yeah, no, so I can imagine.
That sense of your mind being invaded, is it really, you realise that most of the time you're putting everything off. You're always interrupting yourself. It's a culture of continual interruption. So when you don't have that interruption, and you're sort of slipping in and out of strange state of sleep, half sleep, you realise your mind fills up with stuff from all kinds of places that you're not expecting it to.
This has turned into a wellness podcast so fast. We've never done this before. Usually we're like, have you guys heard of this weird sausage?
Yeah. We're like, stop eating.
Valvoline Instant Oil Change presents Wisdom from the Road.
Summer means wide open spaces and a whole lot of extra miles. The last place you want your engine to give out is halfway to nowhere. Out here, low oil or a weak battery is just an ambush waiting to happen. That's why every oil change at Valvoline Instant Oil Change includes an 18-point maintenance check. These techs are trained to help spot issues early and keep you riding easy.
Valvoline Instant Oil Change.
Change wisely.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural, because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Let's crack into our first lunchbox, and this week that is Mitch. What have you got for us?
Well, I have tried today to bring in what I think something similar to what would have been served at the Last Supper.
Okay.
So,
are we going to do the poses?
Yeah, there's only three of us. Yeah. The first thing to say is obviously they would all have been lounging around on the floor. They wouldn't have been. They would have been sitting at a locked table.
All awkwardly on one side.
All on one side, as everybody points out. It's a very odd setup. Obviously, the significance of the Last Supper is fairly profound because it was the Last Supper before Christ's crucifixion, but also it's when he created the sacraments of the bread and the wine. So the bread's really easy, and what I've brought you is my homemade unleavened bread with a bit of spelt flour, because it's a bit, you know, gives it
looks
a bit
so
of,
authentic.
It does look pretty good.
And then I've done quite a bit of research into what would the wine have been.
This looks less authentic.
It is quite a lot less authentic. Unfortunately, there aren't any sort of wines from the Holy Land now that remotely resemble what they would have. They think probably what it would have been some kind of Persian Shiraz type grape.
Ooh.
But they would have kept them for a year to dry out the raisins. They liked fairly thick, rich, probably quite sweet, and often they would have used additives like myrrh to preserve it.
Frankincense and gold fame.
Yeah, yeah.
What is myrrh exactly?
It's a plant. It's an aromatic plant. It's got quite a strong smell. It's supposed to be an analgesic. It's supposed to be a painkiller.
Yeah. Mm.
So famously, Jesus is offered wine with myrrh by Roman soldiers when he's being crucified, and he refuses it.
Right.
The reason being,
because he's a hardcore legend.
Some people
suggest
like
you could just not crucify him instead of offering him painkillers as well.
What's interesting is that myrrh would have been used to embalm the dead. It was a preservative as well.
Okay. But everything was used to embalm the dead.
Just to stop the dead, hot places.
They really basted their their dead.
Well, if you think about it, I suppose burying, which is what we do, is a fairly successful way of getting rid of a corpse. But putting them in tombs with stones, which is what happened with Jesus.
Well, it didn't work with him, famously. He got out.
And what I've brought is a vermouth that is made with myrrh, and a wine that is made by drying the raisins, Amarone, which is an Italian wine.
Nice.
So my suggestion is that if we have maybe 2/3 of the wine and 1/3 vermouth, we will get something that more or less resembles what they might have been drinking on that evening 2,000 years ago. Let's pour. I'm not sure how nice it is, to be brutally honest. It
smells really Christmassy.
Yes.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
Okay, it is. It's very heady.
I'm quite pleased with that. That's sweet, strong.
Yeah,
kind of aromatic.
I'd have that with dessert. Not gonna lie, really good dessert
it's
wine.
Yeah, it's quite dessert winey actually. Yeah,
My research threw up also a broader menu for the meal,
nice.
Which has been based on two Italian researchers, archaeologists, and they would have had stone kind of. Not stone cutlery, but stone plates and stone glasses. They think the menu would have been cholent, which is a stewed dish of beans cooked very low and slow.
Yeah.
Probably lamb, because it was Passover and the lamb would have been lamb would have been killed. They would have had olives with hyssop. Hyssop is, another sort of minty herb.
Mm.
And bitter herbs with pistachios. The bitter herbs were part of the Seder meal.
Oh, very nice.
A date charoset, which again is like a kind of cooked down sort of sweet paste that you probably would have served with the meat. Chunky fruit and nut paste. And sear.
Oh, that sounds nice. Well, like cabbages.
Yeah. It's, and sear, which is a fish paste, like garum, you know, the famous that comes up always with Roman dishes. So a kind of, it feels very Moro, the whole thing.
Yeah. I was going to say, a bit of
herb salad, a bit of slow roast lamb, a bit of a date thing, charoset on the side. And then obviously this, the unleavened bread.
So should we talk about communion more generally then? Could you explain what it is, Mitch, for anyone who's not familiar?
Yeah, I mean, it's the central bit of the Eucharist, which is the most people know as the sort of Sunday morning service. The priest celebrates, basically reenacts the Last Supper, where the bread and the wine are seen to be the representation or the real presence of Christ, his body and his blood. Here's the thing, I do love this because it's one of the things that everybody likes to point out about the slight ridiculousness of the church, although there are some really good reasons for it. The idea is, if you're a Catholic, then most people know that what Catholics believe in is what's known as transubstantiation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this goes back to the Aristotelian kind of division between accident and substance.
Right. Okay.
The accident is what things look like, you know, what they, the colour, but the substance is the is their substance.
Mm.
And what they say is the accident remains the same, still looks like red and white,
mm-hmm.
but the substance changes.
Right.
Mm.
Now, the the Orthodox Church say, yeah, we believe that too, but we don't like the word transubstantiation. We think it's just a real deep mystery.
Wow.
See, in the Protestant Church, there is another way around it, which mm-hmm. is consubstantiation, which mm-hmm. said it's both things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The Anglicans both believe in the real presence, that is, that Christ is really present in the Eucharist. But according to Article 28 of the Articles of Religion, transubstantiation is repugnant to the plain words of Scripture. So once again, it's just like, we don't like this fancy word. And then if you're evangelical, you just think it's a symbol. You don't think there's anything going
on. Right, yeah.
It's been argued over forever and will continue, I think. But really, the real division is whether you think it's just a symbol or whether you think something
has happened.
Has actually happened.
But then I always think the worry with doing that is then you're leaning closer and closer to science and be like, yeah, but on what level? Because is it an atomic level? Because we now know the atomic level exists. And like, do you really want to go down that road and trying to work out?
Quantum Eucharist, My belief always in this is I'm slightly with the Orthodox. I love the mystery. I think trying to apply, as you say, empirical evidence to this is slightly misses the point of what's going on.
Yeah.
It's a ritual. Mm-hmm. It's a ritual that has been performed for 2,000 years, more or less in the same way, which is it's pretty astonishing.
It's amazing.
When you think how much has gone on and how many wars and martyrdoms and heresies. But here it is, and it is absolutely the core of the Christian Eucharist each week. I just love that the fact it's based, the most important bit of Christianity is based around a meal.
Mm-hmm.
And the memory of a meal. And I love the simplicity of it. I love the fact that bread and wine are seen as the most humble things.
Yeah, the most basic.
You can have a meal with just bread and wine. Everybody, we've all done it. We've all been students.
Boy dinner.
Boy dinner, indeed.
I found that the phrase hocus pocus might be down to communion because you say hoc est corpus, which means in Latin means like here is the body.
Here is the body.
So hoc est corpus, hocus pocus. Like you can kind of see that being.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
The thing about the New Testament though is he was absolutely crazed for food, Jesus. I mean, there are 20 separate meal situations in across the four Gospels, which is right up there with miracles. You know, he was when he wasn't healing people, he was sitting down and eating. This idea that, you know, sort of radical inclusion.
Yeah.
That you should break bread with everybody, should eat with everybody.
But it's also a lot to do. This is another thing I was reading when you think about restrictions and taboos. Yeah. It's such a big part of community building, but also an act of trust. Like if we're eating together and we're eating the same food, it means that I trust that you're not trying to kill me.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is a really big part of...
It's like the ancient concept of Xenia and stuff like that. Yeah, like it all comes down to meals and food and breaking bread. And feeding of the 5,000.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. That was a really big one, I think. He was teaching a large crowd. The attendance listed was about 5,000 men.
Ooh.
But that could not have included women and children. So there might have been like 10,000 people there.
Wow. How many teenagers as well? Because teenagers are hungry.
Good point. Yes. And then the only thing that was available were 5 barley loaves and 2 fish.
That's it.
But he managed to pull off this mass catering event. I had a look though just to see whether you could today feed people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. So the Guinness World Record for the largest loaves ever made were 1,571 kilograms by a Brazilian in 2008. So 5 of those would provide 7.8 tons of bread. Promising start. And then the largest recorded caught Atlantic bluefish tuna, they each weighed 678 kilograms each. And I suppose you prep it, about half of that's going to be edible, so 2 of those is about the same.
I think even more, you know, like fish bones are quite light.
Let's say like 700 kilograms. So shared amongst 10,000 people, everyone could get 780 grams of bread and 70 grams of fish, which is a substantial meal.
That's plenty. That works.
I'm just loving the idea of very, very large fish. It is one of the stories that's in all 4 Gospels, which is pretty interesting.
I also just like, it's not about like whether or not it actually happened, how it happened, but I quite like looking at maybe what could have been the inspiration for a story. So I also looked at the concept of manna, like this kind of divinely provided food. So it was when the Israelites were in the wilderness for 40 years and they're starving, and then every morning they
find 20 years less than the English football team.
And every morning this substance that can nourish them, that which they called manna, they think that it might come from the Hebrew for what is this, like as in asking what is this, is man who, like as a question. So that's potentially where the word comes from. And so it appears each morning, and it's like with the dew, as this kind of very fine flaky substance.
So there are all sorts of theories, aren't there? Some insect that
So there's something called tamarisk honeydew, is it sounds like someone I went to school with, actually, but tamarisk is this hard shrub. It's a bit kind of like a cactus, I guess. And there are certain insects that kind of feed on it, and then they pierce it, and then this kind of carbohydrate rich liquid comes out, and it's called honeydew, and then it can kind of harden, and so in the morning when the sun comes up it will have appeared, but then it disappears because it evaporates as it gets hotter. And you can eat it, and so like that could kind of inspire, because that would have disappeared during the day. And so I think it's really interesting. There's some like real explanations for like what's the story.
Always.
Do you know much about the seven deadly sins, Mitch?
I know a little.
Yeah.
Ooh, which is your favourite?
Are we asking a priest to be that question?
You know, it's very interesting. The belief is that we're all born with these, the capacity to
predisposition to sin,
And they were codified, I think, somewhere around about 300-400. I can't remember now the guy who codified
them. I think it was Evagrius Ponticus in the 4th century. Indeed.
And there's an order. Pride is at the top.
Yeah.
And lust is at the bottom. So there are the sins of the spirit, and then there are sins of the body. Gluttony, obviously, is there.
Exactly. That's the one I was looking at, because I heard of the seven deadly sins and I knew that it was gluttony and sloth. But I didn't know that there were types of gluttony. There are subsections. Yeah. So Gregory the Great identified five forms. They are nimis, which is eating too much, the obvious form.
The one that most of us assume.
Yeah, exactly. Then there's pride propere, which is eating too soon or at the wrong time. So I guess that's like digging in before anyone else has arrived and stuff like that. Sneaking into the cupboards.
It's definitely me.
Ardenter, which is too eagerly or too greedily. So like... Laute, which is seeking food too costly or refined.
Yeah. Ooh,
so like Waitrose.
That's so good.
Or eating in London anywhere at all. Or studiosi, which is the most interesting one, being too fussy about preparation, taste and appearance.
Yeah, annoying.
Wow.
So you can't be too fussy, but you can't scoff it down.
Another bit of digging someone did. This is not factual at all. This is very much Da Vinci Code style. But whilst we're talking about the Last Supper, I love this so much. In 2007, there was an Italian musician who was studying at Oxford called Giovanni Maria Palla, who discovered a hidden tune in Da Vinci's painting of the Last Supper.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
But the mental gymnastics you have to do to get to this tune is amazing. So what he did is he put a score over the whole painting, and then he mapped where the hands were and where the bread was and made those into musical notes. And then because Da Vinci loved writing things backwards, he also played the music backwards. And then if you play that melody, it's actually pretty sick.
Ba 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 ba. All right, it is time for our second lunchbox, and that is mine. And I have brought a totally normal melon, which I've cut in half. And oh my god,
what?
It's a miracle. The pips have formed the words Jesus.
It's also miraculous that the watermelon has corn pips.
Yeah, well, that in a miracle in modern science, I didn't realize it was seedless.
It doesn't have any.
There were no seeds for me to rearrange, so I had to use popcorn.
That's brilliant.
I love it.
Obviously, very disrespectful and sacrilegious, but don't worry, my point is not.
People do see these things everywhere, don't they?
They do. I thought we'd start by talking about some of the original, quote-unquote, ancient miracles in the scripture, and also in the hagiography, which is the word for the writings about the saints and kind of the stories around religion that's not specifically the Bible. And then I want to talk about some of the more modern phenomena that have occurred throughout the years. The really disgusting thing that I found, there's a lot of records of saints eating scabs and drinking the pus of poor people. It's Angela Foligno, who lived from 1248 to 1309. She was like an Italian mystic. And she would wash lepers' sores and then drink their used bath water.
This is the side to religious history that I find quite hard to deal with.
Yeah. She also, there's a story of her swallowing a scab that got caught in her throat. I guess she licked it off.
Yeah.
But she said it tasted as sweet as the Eucharist.
Yeah.
What is the moral tale behind this one, the scabs and the bathwater?
It's a really good point. I don't know. It's called extreme ascetism.
It's self-conishment. Yeah. In order to sort of chastise the flesh, it's this sort of idea that the flesh is wicked and weak, and that you have to in a way punish and torture yourself to show the depth of your faith.
Okay.
It's one of those things when you read the Gospels, you think, which Bible are you reading?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't really see this. It's the hair shirt idea, the rejection of all forms of comfort.
Very kind of like competitive in some ways as well. Yeah, it does feel like LinkedIn bio. I spent this morning eating the scabs of a leper.
Yeah.
Really inspiring. Yum. So those are all my favourite ones from the olden days.
Oh, okay.
But modern day, they pop up in the news occasionally. Mm-hmm. There's a lot out there, like, the internet has a lot of information on it, but no one's really done a study and assembled them all together and done a little bit of analysis on them.
Ooh.
So I've come up with a fairly long list of major food-related modern miracles that were reported on by the press in some form or another.
Love it.
So starting with the Jesus tortilla in 1977, very famous.
Legendary.
The 5th of October 1977, Maria Rubio in New Mexico basically was preparing a tortilla, and she noticed that the scorch marks resembled the face of Jesus, and her family made a small shrine. 35,000 people, they think, went to visit it over the next months. And for years, they kept it. And it's kind of one of the original food miracles, I think, like one of the most famous ones. And it was really widely reported. I tried to find out what happened to it. It gradually faded, the image, but they kept it. In 2005, it was dropped during a school presentation and broke.
The tortilla broke.
Yeah, I think it must have been very hard and stale by that point. Whoa. And it was in a box. And they in 2005, though, so it lasted a really long time.
That's good.
A tortilla, of course, unleavened bread, really.
Ah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's actually, there's an actual connection there. Mm-hmm. Less so the Virgin Mary grilled cheese sandwich.
I know this
from 1994.
Oh, yeah.
So quite a big gap, okay? Mm-hmm. 1977 to 1994. This is a woman in Florida who found the Virgin Mary's face on a grilled cheese sandwich after she'd taken a bite of it. And she preserved it for 10 years. And she then auctioned it in 2004. And it was bought by the online casino goldenpalace.com for $28,000.
Wow.
Which is amazing. And they put it in a case and exhibited it. And this interests me because this was the first of several of these miracle foods that Golden Palace bought. So basically somewhere out there, it's a bit mysterious, there is the owner of an online casino who is buying up all of these miracle foods.
He's got an upstairs room somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. They also bought, in 2005, the pretzel Madonna and Child. Just a pretzel that looks like the Virgin Mary holding baby Jesus.
Pretzels also have a potentially churchy background because they're meant to have been inspired by children in prayer, that knot in the arm made by a monk.
Oh, really?
Is the legendary story.
Okay, but they spent over $10,000 on that one
eBay.
And they also bought the Holy Pierogi in 2005.
Nice.
It was Donna Lee of Ohio.
Holy Pierogi.
Holy Pierogi, exactly. A pierogi that appeared to form the face of Jesus, but for only $1,700. I think you can see that the market is sort of beginning to collapse around kind of the mid-noughties. Mm-hmm. Some other great ones I like was the Mother Teresa Nun Bun. That was back in 1996.
A nun bun. Nice.
A cinnamon bun resembling Mother Teresa, which was discovered at Bongo Java in Nashville, which I think is a cafe. And they put it in a glass case, sold merchandise, until Mother Teresa herself asked the owners to stop doing it. Received a cease and desist from Mother Teresa, which is something I would rather have on display than the original bun. But on Christmas Day 2005, a burglar stole the bun.
Wow.
And it's never been recovered. It's been missing ever since.
I do love all this stuff. Why is it always food?
A couple more of my favourites. Chocolate Virgin Mary in 2006. This would be perfect for Easter, actually.
That sounds like a really good cocktail.
So
workers at Bodega Chocolates in California in 2006 discovered a hardened column of chocolate beneath a vat that had sort of been leaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of hardened. So I'm kind of thinking it's like the elephant's foot in Chernobyl. It's hardened into a kind of like stalagmite.
Uh-huh.
And it reminded them of the Virgin Mary. And the company said they were going to preserve it. But again, it's gone missing. All of these, they all go missing.
People are eating them. dinner. People are definitely,
I think it's too
eating.
Tempting not to. Yeah. Anyway, so I was looking all of these up and I made a kind of long list. There's the Dallas cheeses, the Marmite Messiah, Jesus on a banana, the Brisbane Jesus pizza, the Rosario Jesus empanada. So I kind of crunched the numbers a bit, made a couple of charts, and I kind of have some bad news for fans of this. Really, we've passed the peak of these food miracles happening. It was the internet age. Between 1977 and the 1990s, there were only about 70 major reported ones. 2000s, 2010s, there were 14, 15 a year. Wow. So that was like really like the peak.
Peak Facebook, isn't it?
Yeah. Last 5 years, there's only been six. So
amazing.
You can, if you want to, bring it back. There's a company that makes toasters that prints Jesus's face on your toast, which I am very tempted to buy.
Okay, first of all, the budget does not stretch to that kind of custom toaster. Second of all, that completely misses the point.
No, but it's fun, though.
I think it's interesting on the pareidolia thing. So the pareidolia being that phenomenon of seeing faces, or like clouds being in a certain shape.
Yeah.
But most commonly it's faces, because human brains are just really predisposed to see faces.
Have we spoken about this, that before you're born, you do the same thing?
Right.
So when they did tests on babies in utero, they showed three patterns of lights in a triangle. So imagine there's one that's like two dots at the top and then a little one at the bottom, which looks like two eyes and a mouth.
The most basic face shape. Yeah.
And they followed the light pattern with their heads all around.
Wow, so before we're even born.
Yeah, and then
that's
if you
amazing.
Flip it upside down, they don't care at all. They won't follow it.
That's
so it's
amazing.
Like we're hardwired.
The other thing, it's not really the same, but it's that there are now, you know, those critical learning junctures for children are being missed because of Botox. Because young mothers who've had Botox, literally their children can't read the emotional signals because their faces are effectively
neutral.
Dead.
Yeah. Well, this is why I kind of wanted to do this for my lunchbox, because I've decided that it's a really nice thing. Of all of the different controversies in and out of religion and everywhere else and all of the narrative.
It's nicer than swallowing leprosy.
Yeah, it's definitely. Exactly. At the worst, it's like harmless hysteria. At best, there are people out there whose lives are really changed by this. And then they actually go on a pilgrimage and they see something and they feel like they've seen a holy relic. I kind of really like that. So I hope they don't die out. And I hope that people, maybe our listeners can keep an eye out for the Jesuses and the Marys. Yeah.
And or buy the toaster and make your own.
Or buy the toaster and make your own. Yeah.
Valvoline Instant Oil Change presents Wisdom from the Road.
Summer means wide open spaces and a whole lot of extra miles. The last place you want your engine to give out is halfway to nowhere. Out here, low oil or a weak battery is just an ambush waiting to happen. That's why every oil change at Valvoline Instant Oil Change includes an 18-point maintenance check. These techs are trained to help spot issues early and keep you riding easy.
Valvoline Instant Oil Change.
Change wisely.
Ever thought about Botox but worried you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural, because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Okay, let's move on to our third and final lunchbox, and that is from Manu.
Today I am about to make what Mitch has just described as ungodly, which is a mixture of Buckfast and Iron Brew. So this is inspired by a drink that was called Scottish Sangria. a lockdown drink made on Burns Night, and it was talked about in the press quite a lot. That version had Mad Dog 2020 in it as well. I don't know if you know the drink Mad Dog 2020.
No, I don't think I want to either.
Basically like a Scottish Alcopop. So it's Iron Brew, which is a very caffeinated, famously Scottish, wasn't invented in Scotland, but
made
like
in Scotland.
Made in Scotland. Yeah.
Yep. And then I'm going to mix it with some Buckfast tonic wine.
Right.
Which Bucky. Is still exactly Bucky as it's called. And it's still brewed by Benedictine monks. in Devon. So I wanted to talk about the relationship between Christianity and wine, and this kind of tension between it being something that's celebrated and like symbolic. We've spoken a lot about the Eucharist, but also something that is a little bit controversial, not always the best thing. Like intoxication is not exactly encouraged.
So Manny, you've mixed these two drinks together in the color is truly satanic. It's like this like vibrant reddy orange, but then like completely black color.
Oh my god. That is so powerful.
Oh my god.
I have to say, that is not unpleasant.
Do you like it?
It's really not. It's quite cokey, actually.
It's quite cokey.
Coca-Cola, not like cocaine. Well, also that, actually. But
I quite like Bucky. I mean, on its own.
So what is Buckfast?
Okay, so Buckfast is a tonic wine. So it's fortified. It's really, really sweet. And it has caffeine in it.
It's pimped up mead is what it is.
In the 1880s, there was a group of Benedictine monks from France who fled to Devon, fleeing religious persecution. So they settled at the Buckfast Abbey in Devon. A few years later, someone's nephew comes to the abbey with this recipe for tonic wine.
Someone's nephew.
So it's one of the monk's nephews pops over.
That sounds like the devil playing a trick.
You want to make a lot of money?
Whose nephew are you? Don't worry about that.
Anyway, so they start making this fortified wine, which has got lots of sugar in it and lots of caffeine. So it's kind of sold as a medicinal thing.
Do we know what Buckfast means? Why Buckfast Abbey was called that?
It's named after a place where bucks, as in buck deer, are. So there are a lot of bucks in the
male
area.
Deer. Bucking around.
Fueled by all of the Japanese.
Yeah. Now we know why.
So in a typical 740ml bottle of Buckfast, there is the equivalent caffeine of about 10 cans of Coke. So it's like very highly caffeinated. And one of the most interesting things about Buckfast tonic wine is that it is basically synonymous with Ned culture in Glasgow. So Neds is a really controversial term. It's kind of like the equivalent of Chav in England. So it stands for non-educated delinquent. And it's kind of like young guys on the street up to no good. And for some reason, they fell in love with this drink. Probably because it's really strong, it's really cheap, and it gives you a really strong, strong buzz.
I was thinking the shape of the bottle has something to do with it as well. It's just very swiggable. It's quite, it's one of those like flat bottles, shaped like a book. It's kind of Bible sized, actually. It goes in a pocket quite easily.
It is kind of shaped like a hip flask.
That's what I'm thinking more hip flask.
It's really interesting. Talking about the bottle, this is one of the most controversial elements of this drink. So it's got this association with Ned culture in Glasgow. People up to no good, getting really, really drunk, getting buzzed. And in 2010, Buckfast Brewers, so this monastery, comes under fire for not regulating the production. Basically, like, Buckfast was, by that point, involved in so many crimes.
It was a section on the pie chart.
So there was loads of crime Bucky reports. Related. Between 2006 and 2009, it was mentioned in 5,638 reports in this quite small area of Scotland. So people were petitioning the monks, asking them to kind of change their supply, change the recipe.
But do what, though? Stop making it?
And also change the bottle and make it not glass, because Bucky, in the wrong hands, turns into a weapon.
Oh, okay.
But their exact argument was that people are going to drink whatever they're going to drink. People are going to get drunk. People are going to commit crimes. And if we stop providing this, they'll just find something
else. Where do you draw
the
line? Yeah.
Exactly.
It's quite a strong line for a religious community.
It is. But I think it is that slippage between like being involved in so many kind of very unchristian, unholy, quite like dodgy cases. They also have quite a big financial incentive because they're a registered charity, this monastery. Right. They don't pay tax. So they earn a really large sum from making Buckfast. In 2025, the company made over 50 million in Buckfast sales, which is quite, like, it's quite a small production. So, it's a really interesting topic. But I think it is quite tasty, you know. If enjoyed in the right way, maybe 100%. Not mixed with iron brew.
I kind of think the iron brew works quite nicely, actually, as a mixer.
They do now, like, it's quite a trendy drink. So there's a lot of cocktail makers doing stuff with Buckfast. I've actually eaten Buckfast ice cream in Glasgow,
that sounds
which
amazing.
Delicious. Yeah. So, so good.
Does it have honey in it? That's what I was going to ask.
Does it have honey
it's
in it?
It's famously, other thing it's famous for Buckfast is the Buckfast bee. Which was developed by brother Adam.
Who's brother Adam?
He was a German monk, and I think this is after the First World War, and when the British bee, I don't know what you'd call the British bee swarm, the British bee herd, population, that's good, had been severely damaged. The British black bee had been severely damaged by a virus, a mite, and he used Italian bees and British bees to breed a hybrid called the Buckfast bee, which is still, I think, the most popular sort of strain of Apis mellifera to be in the UK. So it's a centre of beekeeping culture as well as a centre of. And I just wonder if the honey is used.
I just looked it up and there's no honey in the wine. No. But that would have been nice. Yeah.
All right. So when I see a bee in the UK,
probably.
A Buckfast bee?
Probably a Buckfast bee. Take a shot in thanks and salute your bee.
It's been the greatest excuse
to be an alcoholic.
getting a buzz on. So I was also looking at whether it is possible to turn water into wine.
Oh, yeah. Did Jesus do that at a wedding?
Yeah, the wedding of Cana.
Yeah, he did. The wedding at Cana, yeah.
That's
Cana?
A good, yeah,
it's
nice.
His first miracle in John's Gospel. And it's a big one.
What was the difficult second miracle after that?
That's a good question. Some healing situation. But, you know, we've all been in that situation. Mm-hmm. We're running out of wine.
Yeah.
What are we gonna
do? Sure he didn't just nip to the offie and everyone's like, it's a miracle?
It says he turned about 120 gallons of water into wine.
Wow.
It was a lot.
That
is
a lot.
Big
okay,
miracle.
Yeah.
So the only thing I could find on this was a very recent study by the University of Kyoto that says it's turned water into wine.
They've done it.
With grapes.
Yeah. I mean, I did sort of think that, yeah.
These scientists were using raisins, which is, I think, the exciting bit. So basically...
So you're basically saying, how could you do it as like a party trick where you're bringing some raisins in your pocket?
Yeah.
And could you use those
you
to turn the water into wine?
You need to wait about 2 weeks.
Right.
But if you leave raisins in water, they will start to naturally ferment because of the yeasts on the outside of the raisins that survive. So they managed to make wine out of just water and a few grapes in the bottom of the glass, which is pretty miraculous, I think. I wouldn't expect it. When he was interviewed, one of the graduate students working on the project, Mamuro Hio, said that some of it was drinkable, and I'm going to take that as a win, I think.
As you say, the ingredient that Jesus seemed to provide that he fast-tracked was time.
Yes, yeah.
And then I looked at the kind of transubstantiation element to it, the great mystery, and I came across something called deer blood wine.
Deer blood wine, as in the animal deer?
Yeah, so the animal deer, there's an ancient Chinese medicine that makes a sort of wine out of the blood of deers, and it's supposed to help with all sorts of incredible ailments like arthritis, mostly fatigue. It's supposed to be like a great fortifier, but what they do is they take like literal deer blood,
like bucky made out of actual bugs.
Now that you say it like that, it sounds like Slim Fast but made of deer.
Oh, God. So they make it with kind of another type of alcohol, and then they let it all ferment together, and they use it medicinally.
Wow.
And it's used to the extent that there are modern studies on the effectiveness of deer blood wine.
I've just read your notes over your shoulder, and I just see the word mice on treadmills.
So in 2021, there was a group of researchers in Jinan University in China that were testing the effectiveness of fermented deer blood on mice. So they did exactly that. They put the mice on treadmills and they gave some treadmill mice fermented deer blood wine, and they gave others a kind of placebo or nothing at all. And they found that, fermented deer blood significantly reduces metabolic byproduct accumulation, liver and intestinal damage, and enhances glycogen storage.
What does that mean? They are just more energetic. And
they can go a lot faster if you give them fermented deer blood.
It basically is Bucky, though.
Yeah, that's true. And then the mice set fire to a Ford Fiesta. Glasgow High Street. Okay, that is it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for 3D facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions, or suggestions for future topics by emailing us, lunchbox@qi.com.
Mitch, this is usually the part of the show where our guest recommends a recipe. Maybe you can recommend a verse or...
a recipe? The thing I'm going to take away from this is the... What's it called? Glaswegian sangria.
Scottish sangria.
Scottish sangria. Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me slightly, it has that... Keris Matthews has this brilliant thing called Death by Chocolate. Nothing religious about it, although why not? It could be. It's basically a shot of vodka, a shot of Tira Maria, put in the bottom of a pint glass, and you fill the pint glass up with draft Guinness. It's an astonishingly delicious drink.
That sounds amazing.
I really couldn't recommend it higher. It's just enough chocolate in there for it to make the Guinness taste slightly different and slightly kind of celebratory.
Oh, it sounds quite Christmassy.
It is very Christmassy. I can't see it taking over from Buckfast anytime soon.
Maybe that could be your brand of union wine when you start doing stuff. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Delighted to be here.
A real pleasure. And we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Onryo and me, Alex Bell, with special guest John Mitchinson. This has been a quite interesting podcast.
Looking for your next thrifting experience? Check out the new Goodwill Columbus location in Westerville. Our new store is full of the latest secondhand selections with options rotating daily. From warm weather clothes to home decor, you may find your new favorite items just in time for spring. Each purchase helps us create opportunities throughout Central Ohio. It's shopping that looks good, feels good, and does good. Come shop at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Got stubborn spots, unwanted hair, or uneven skin? The CAPS Laser Center offers advanced solutions. They offer a full range of advanced laser treatments like Halo and Moxie that help reveal smoother, clearer, healthier-looking skin. CAPS is one of the top providers in the world for laser treatments, and their expert team delivers personalized care every step of the way. When you book your first Laser Center appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. So don't wait. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.